I am going to try to read this outside Nero. And the tram car goes by. I will pause. But can I pause on this thing? Oh well. The Delicate Prey by Paul Bowles. There were three Falala who sold leather in Tabalbala. Two brothers and the young son of their sister. The two older merchants were serious, bearded men who liked to engage in complicated theological discussions during the slow passage of the hot hours in their hanut near the marketplace. The youth naturally occupied himself almost exclusively with the black-skinned girls in the small quartier réservé. There was one who seemed more desirable than the others, so that he was a little sorry when the older man announced that soon they would all leave for Tessalit. But nearly every town has its quartier, and Driss was reasonably certain of being able to have any lovely resident of any quartier, whatever her present emotional entanglements. Thus his chagrin at hearing of the projected departure was short-lived. The three Falala waited for the cold weather before starting out for Tessalit. Because they wanted to get there quickly, they chose the westernmost trail, which is also the one leading through the most remote regions contiguous to the lands of the plundering Wiguiba tribes. It was a long time since the uncouth mountain men had swept down from the Hamada upon a caravan. Most people were of the opinion that since the War of the Sarho, they had lost the greater part of their arms and ammunition, and, more important still, their spirit. And a tiny group of three men and their camels would scarcely awaken the envy of the Regoibat, traditionally rich with loot from all Rio de Oro and Mauritania. Their friends in Tabalbala, most of them other Falali leather merchants, walked beside them sadly as far as the edge of the town. Then they bade them farewell and watched them mount their camels to ride off slowly toward the bright horizon. If you meet any Regoiba, keep them ahead of you, they called. The danger lay principally in the territory they would reach only 3 or 4 days' journey from Tabalbala. After a week, the edge of the land haunted by the Regoiba would be left entirely behind. The weather was cool, save at midday. They took turns sitting guard at night. When Driss stayed awake, he brought out a small flute, whose piercing notes made the older uncle frown with annoyance, so that he asked him to go and sit at some distance from the sleeping blankets. All night he sat playing whatever sad songs he could call to mind. The bright ones, in his opinion, belonged to the quartier where one was never alone. When the uncles kept watch, they sat quietly, staring ahead of them into the night. There were just the three of them. And then one day a solitary figure appeared, moving toward them across the lifeless plain from the west. One man on a camel. There was no sign of any others, although they scanned the wasteland in every direction. They stopped for a while. He altered his course slightly. They went ahead. He changed it again. There was no doubt that he wanted to speak with them. Let him come, grumbled the older uncle, glaring about the empty horizon once more. We each have a gun. Tris laughed. To him it seemed absurd, even to admit the possibility of trouble from one lone man. When finally the figure arrived within calling distance, it hailed them in a voice like a muezzin's, "Salam alaikum." They halted, but did not dismount, and waited for the man to draw nearer. Soon he called again. This time the older man replied. The older uncle replied. But the distance was still too great for his voice to carry, and the man did not hear his greeting. Presently he was close enough for them to see that he did not wear Reguiba attire. They muttered to one another, "He comes from the north, not the west," and they all felt glad. However, even when he came up beside them, they remained on the camels, bowing solemnly from where they sat, and always searching in the new face and in the garments below it for some false note which might reveal the possible truth that the man was a scout for the Reguibat, who would be waiting up on the Hamada only a few hours distant, or even now moving parallel to the trail, closing in upon them in such a manner that they would not arrive at a point within visibility until after dusk. Certainly the stranger himself was no Reguiba. He was quick and jolly, with light skin and very little beard. It occurred to Driss that he did not like his small, active eyes, which seemed to take in everything and give out nothing. But this passing reaction became only a part of the general initial distrust, all of which was dissipated when they learned that the man was a Mungari. Mungar is a holy place in that part of the world, and its few residents are treated with respect by the pilgrims who go to visit the ruined shrine nearby. The newcomer took no pains to hide the fear he had felt at being alone in the region, or the pleasure it gave him to be now with three other men. They all dismounted and made tea to seal their friendship, the Mungari furnishing the charcoal. During the third round of glasses, he made the suggestion that since he was going more or less in their direction, he accompany them as far as Tudeni. His bright black eyes darting from one filali to the other, he explained that he was an excellent shot, that he was certain he could supply them all with some good gazelle meat en route, or at least an audad. The filala considered. The oldest finally said, "Agreed." Even if the Mungari turned out to have not quite the hunting prowess he claimed for himself, there would be four of them on the voyage instead of three. Two mornings later, in the mighty silence of the rising sun, the Mungari pointed at the low hills that lay beside them to the east. "Tima, I know this land. Wait here. If you hear me shoot, then come, because that will mean there are gazelles." The Mungari went off on foot, climbing up between the boulders and disappearing behind the nearest crest. "He trusts us," thought the Filala. "He has left his mehari, his blankets, his packs." They said nothing, but each knew that the others were thinking the same as he, and they all felt warmly toward the stranger. They sat waiting in the early morning chill while the camels grumbled. It seemed unlikely that there would prove to be any gazelles in the region, but if there should be any, and the Mungari were as good a hunter as he claimed to be, then there was a chance they would have a mechoui of gazelle that evening, and that would be very fine. slowly the sun mounted in the hard blue sky. One camel lumbered up and went off, hoping to find a dead thistle or a bush between the rocks, something left over from a year when rain might have fallen. When it had disappeared, Driss went in search of it and drove it back to the others, shouting, "What?" He sat down. Suddenly there came a shot, a long empty interval, and then another shot. The sounds were fairly distant, but perfectly clear in the absolute silence. The older brother said, "I shall go. Who knows? There may be many gazelles." He clambered up the rocks, his gun in his hand, and was gone. Again they waited. When the shots sounded this time, they came from two guns. "Perhaps they have killed one," Driss cried. "Yemkin, with Allah's aid," replied his uncle, rising and taking up his gun. "I want to try my hand at this." Driss was disappointed. He had hoped to go himself. If only he had got up a moment ago, it might have been possible, but even so it was likely that he would have been left behind to watch the Mehara. In any case, now it was too late. His uncle had spoken. Good. His uncle went off singing a song from Tiflit. It was about date palms and hidden smiles. For several minutes, Driss heard snatches of the song as the melody reached the high notes. Then the sound was lost in the enveloping silence. He waited. The sun began to be very hot. He covered his head with his burnous. The camels looked at each other stupidly, craning their necks, baring their brown and yellow teeth. He thought of playing his flute, but it did not seem the right moment. He was too restless, too eager to be up there with his gun, crouching behind the rocks, stalking the delicate prey. He thought of Tessalit and wondered what it would be like. Full of blacks and Tuareg, certainly more lively than Tabalbala, because of the road that passed through it. There was a shot. He waited for others, but no more came this time. Again he imagined himself there among the boulders, taking aim at a fleeing beast. He pulled the trigger, the animal fell, others appeared, and he got them all. In the dark, the travelers sat around the fire, gorging themselves with rich roasted flesh. Their faces... gleaming with grease. Everyone was happy, and even the Mungari admitted that the young Fulali was the best hunter of them all. In the advancing heat, he dozed, his mind playing over a landscape made of soft thighs and small hard breasts rising like sand dunes. Wisps of song floated like clouds in the sky, and the air was thick with the taste of fat gazelle meat. He sat up and looked around quickly. The camels lay with their necks stretched along the ground in front of them. Nothing had changed. He stood up, uneasily scanned the stony landscape. While he had slept, a hostile presence had entered into his consciousness, translating into thought what he already sensed. He cried out. Since first he had seen those small, active eyes, he had felt mistrust of their owner. But the fact that his uncles had accepted him had pushed suspicion away into the dark of his mind. Now, unleashed in his slumber, it had bounded back. He turned toward the hot hillside and looked intently between the boulders into the black shadows. In memory, he heard again the shots up among the rocks, and he knew what they had meant. Catching his breath in a sob, he ran to mount his Mahari, forced it up, and already had gone several hundred paces before he was aware of what he was doing. He stopped the animal to sit quietly a moment, glancing back at the campsite with fear and indecision. If his uncles were dead, then there was nothing to do but get out into the open desert as quickly as possible, away from the rocks that could hide the Mungari while he took aim. And so, not knowing the way to Tessalite and without sufficient food or water, he started ahead, lifting one hand from time to time to wipe away the tears. For 2 or 3 hours he continued that way, scarcely noticing where the Mahari walked. All at once he sat erect, uttered an oath against himself, and in a fury turned the beast around. At that very moment, his uncles might be seated in the camp with the Mungari preparing a maitchui and a fire, sadly asking themselves why their nephew had deserted them. Or perhaps one would already have set out in search of him. There would be no possible excuse for his conduct, which had been the result of an absurd terror. As he thought about it, his anger against himself mounted. He had behaved in an unforgivable manner. Noon had passed. The sun was in the west. It would be late when he got back, and the prospect of the inevitable reproaches and the mocking laughter that would greet him. He felt his face grow hot with shame, and he killed the Mahari's flanks viciously. A good while before he arrived at the camp, he heard singing. This surprised him. He halted and listened. The voice was too far away to be identified, but Driss felt certain it was the Mungari's. He continued around the side of the hill to a spot in full view of the camels. The singing stopped, leaving silence. Some of the packs had been loaded back onto the beasts preparatory to setting out. The sun had sunk low, and the shadows of the rocks were stretched out along the earth. There was no sign that they had caught any game. He called out, ready to dismount. Almost at the same instant, there was a shot from very nearby, and he heard the small rushing sound of a bullet go past his head. He seized his gun. There was another shot, a sharp pain in his arm, and his gun slipped to the ground. For a moment he sat there holding his arm, dazed. Then swiftly he leapt down and remained crouching among the stones, reaching out with his good arm for the gun. As he touched it, there was a third shot, and the rifle moved along the ground a few inches toward him in a small cloud of dust. He drew back his hand and looked at it. It was dark, and blood dripped from it. At that moment, the Mungari bounded across the open space. Between them. Before Driss could rise, the man was upon him, had pushed him back down to the ground with the barrel of his rifle. The untroubled sky lay above. The Mungari glanced up at it defiantly. He straddled the supine youth, thrusting the gun into his neck just below the chin. And under his breath, he said, "Fulali dog." Driss stared up at him with a certain curiosity. The Mungari had the upper hand. Driss could only wait. He looked at the face in the sun's light and discovered a peculiar intensity there. He knew the expression. It comes from hashish. Carried along on its hot fumes, a man can escape very far from the world of meaning. To avoid the malevolent face, he rolled his eyes from side to side. There was only the fading sky. The gun was choking him a little. He whispered, "Where are my uncles?" The Mungari pushed harder against his throat with the gun, leaned partially over, and with one hand ripped away his sarouels so that he lay naked from the waist down, squirming a little as he felt the cold stones beneath him. Then the Mungari drew forth rope and bound his feet. Taking two steps to his head, he abruptly faced in the other direction and thrust the gun into his navel. Still with one hand, he slipped the remaining garments off over the youth's head and lashed his wrists together. With an old barber's razor, he cut off the superfluous rope. During this time, Driss called his uncles by name, loudly, first one and then the other. The man moved and surveyed the young body lying on the stones. He ran his finger along the razor's blade. A pleasant excitement took possession of him. He stooped over, looked down, and saw the sex that sprouted from the base of the belly. Not entirely conscious of what he was doing, he took it in one hand and brought his other arm down with the motion of a reaper wielding a sickle. It was swiftly severed. A round, dark hole was left, flush with the skin. He stared a moment, blankly. Driss was screaming. The muscles all over his body stood out, moved. Slowly the Mungari smiled, showing his teeth. He put his hand on the hard belly and smoothed the skin. Then he made a small vertical incision there, and using both hands, studiously stuffed the loose organ in until it disappeared. As he was cleaning his hands in the sand, one of the camels uttered a sudden growling gurgle. The Mungari leaped up and wheeled about savagely, holding his razor high in the air. Then, ashamed of his nervousness, feeling that Driss was watching and mocking him, although the youth's eyes were unseeing with pain, he kicked him over onto his stomach, where he lay making small spasmodic movements. And as the Mungari followed these with his eyes, a new idea came to him. It would be pleasant to inflict an ultimate indignity upon the young Fulali. He threw himself down. This time he was vociferous and leisurely in his enjoyment. Eventually he slept. At dawn he awoke and reached for his razor. Lying on the ground nearby, Driss moaned faintly. The Mungari turned him over and pushed the blade back and forth with a sawing motion into his neck until he was certain he had severed the windpipe. Then he rose, walked away, and finished the loading of the camels he had started the day before. When this was done, he spent a good while dragging the body over to the base of the hill and concealing it there among the rocks. In order to transport the Falala's merchandise to Tessalit, for in Tuordani there would be no buyers, it was necessary to take their Mehara with him. It was nearly 50 days later when he arrived. Tessalit is a small town. When the Mungari began to show the leather around, an old Falala living there, whom the people called Echibani, got wind of his presence. As a prospective buyer, he came to examine the hides, and the Mungari was unwise enough to let him see them. Falali leather is unmistakable, and only the Falala buy and sell it in quantity. Echibani knew the Mungari had come by it illicitly, but he said nothing. When a few days later another caravan arrived from Tabalbala with friends of the three Falala, who asked after them and showed great distress on hearing that they had never arrived, the old man went to the tribunal. After some difficulty, he found a Frenchman who was willing to listen to him. The next day, the commandant and two subordinates paid the Mungari a visit. They asked him how he happened to have the three extra Mahara, which still carried some of their Falali trappings. His replies took a devious turn. The Frenchman listened seriously, thanked him, and left. He did not see the commandant wink at the others as they went out into the street, and so he remained sitting in his courtyard, not knowing that he had been judged and found guilty. The three Frenchmen went back to the tribunal where the newly arrived Falali merchants were sitting with Echibani. The story had an old pattern. There was no doubt at all about the Mungari's guilt. "He is yours," said the commandant. "Do what you like with him." The Falala thanked him profusely, held a short conference with the aged Echibani, and rode out in a group. When they arrived at the Mungari's dwelling, he was making tea. He looked up, and a chill moved along his spine. He began to scream his innocence at them. They said nothing, but at the point of a rifle, bound him and tossed him into a corner, where he continued to babble and sob. Quietly, they drank the tea he had been brewing, made some more, and went out at twilight. They tied him to one of the Mahara, and, mounting their own, moved in a silent procession, silent save for the Mungari, out through the town gate into the infinite wasteland beyond. Half the night they continued until they were in a completely unfrequented region of the desert. While he lay raving, bound to the camel, they dug a well-lit pit. And when they had finished, they lifted him off, still trussed tightly, and stood him in it. Then they filled all the space around his body with sand and stones, until only his head remained above the earth's surface. In the faint light of the new moon, his shaved pate, without its turban, looked rather like a rock. And still he pleaded with them, calling upon Allah and Sidi Ahmed ben Musa to witness his innocence. But he might have been singing a song for all the attention they paid to his words. Presently they set off for Tessalit. In no time they were out of hearing. When they had gone, the Mungari fell silent to wait through the cold hours for the sun that would bring first warmth, then heat, thirst, fire, visions. The next night, he did not know where he was, did not feel the cold. The wind blew dust along the ground into his mouth as he sang.